produce Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at KFAI.org, the community's true voice.
Welcome to Miniculture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area, or BWCA, is known as one of the most beautiful places in the country. But it can also be a dangerous place, as KFAI producer Joe Fredericks shares in this story.
What Maddie Fondline remembers the most about the lightning bolt that struck down at her campsite in the Boundary Waters is the sound it made.
I have never been a fan of loud noises, but I remember watching the lightning come down, and then I really viscerally remember the feeling of the thunder, which was just so loud. It made my ears hurt so bad, and it also just kind of felt like something had grabbed my sternum and just like shaked it really violently. It was just like a very like whole body visceral feeling of my bones just like rattling from the vibrations from the thunder.
The lightning strike Fondline describes took place on Knife Lake in Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in July 2019. The BWCA, as the wilderness is often referred to, is a rugged and vast landscape consisting of lakes, streams, bogs, and dense forest. Fondline is extremely experienced in this canoe country wilderness. She's made more than a dozen visits to Knife Lake alone over the course of her life. During the 2019 summer outing to the Boundary Waters, Fondline was a guide for a group of seven Girl Scouts from the Chicago area. After the lightning bolt hit the campsite, Fondline fell backward. Despite the initial setback, she almost immediately sprung to action to check on the teenage girls. Five of them had clearly been impacted by the lightning. Indeed, the situation was serious. One of the scouts said she saw electricity come through her fingers after the current moved through her body. Another scout said she lost all feeling in one of her legs after the lightning strike.
Some of them were like what at the time I listed as critical patients, quote unquote. Because I wasn't sure how they were going to present the farther on the night goes. Typically with lightning strikes, the farther after the strike, the more symptoms begin to present. And so that was something I was concerned about, is like, what's going to happen in a couple hours? Are you going to get better? Are you going to get worse?
What Fondline did know is that her group needed help. Using a communication radio, she was able to relay back to the scout base that there was a critical situation at their campsite on Knife Lake in the BWCA. The site where the group was camped was in a heavily wooded area, even by BWCA standards, making radio communication difficult. Through a garbled connection, Fondline was able to alert the scout camp closer to Ely that they needed help. The message was then relayed to 911. Following that, the St. Louis County Rescue Squad, based in the Duluth area, was alerted to the situation, and an official search and rescue operation was underway. 7 hours later, Fondline and the scout group safely evacuated from the Canoe Country wilderness. There were injuries, though none of them were life-threatening. Despite the fact the evacuation took place overnight, for the members of the St. Louis County Rescue Squad, it was just another day at the office. Every year, people need to be rescued from the wilderness of Minnesota's Boundary Waters. In modern times, this call for help can come from a cell phone, a UHF handheld radio like the one Fondline used on Knife Lake, or an emergency beacon like a Garmin InReach. When such a call is placed on the west side of the 1.2 million acre BWCA, it's more or less a guarantee that people from the St. Louis County Rescue Squad will be among those responding. And these days, if someone gets in a precarious situation in the Boundary Waters, they can typically ask for help within a few minutes. It wasn't always this efficient. The St. Louis County Rescue Squad has been responding to emergencies in places like the Boundary Waters since the late 1950s. And while communication tools have changed search and rescue operations, the objective remains the same: get people out and get them out safely whenever possible.
Hi, I'm Rick Slatton, captain of the St. Louis County Rescue Squad. My dad was one of the 13 charter members. He started the unit in 1958, so my earliest memories as a kid is watching dad get dressed for a search. And I'd ask him, where are you going? And he'd say, up north. And I had no idea where up north was. It was this mystical, magical place where he always came back with cool stories. So I have the search gene in my DNA.
Slatton has unapologetically allowed that DNA to steer his life for the past five decades. Now in his early 60s, Slatton has been on the rescue squad since 1986, becoming the captain of the organization in 2014. In addition to his family legacy, Slatton says he is drawn to the complex and diverse nature of search and rescue.
There's no common theme. It's all over the map. We could be looking for a five-year-old today and a 88-year-old Alzheimer's patient tomorrow, and then be in the Boundary Waters for someone with an axe in their leg. You know, it's all over the map.
The rescue squad of today is much different than when Slatton's father was involved. In fact, what started with about a dozen people in the summer of 1958 has grown to be an advanced unit with about 100 highly trained members who serve on the St. Louis County Rescue Squad. In the mid-60s, when the rescue squad was still in its infancy, members would respond to somewhere between 10 to 20 calls each year, totaling out at approximately 100 hours of response time between all the members. In 2022, the rescue squad had more than 500 calls, with the volunteers logging almost 34,000 hours collectively. The origins of search and rescue operations inside the BWCA traces back to 1964 in the federal designation establishing the Boundary Waters as a wilderness area. People from all over the country came here to canoe, camp, fish, hike, and escape the grind of city life. This is an area inhabited by wolves, moose, bears, loons, and other wildlife. The BWCA contains nearly 1,200 lakes, varying in size from shallow ponds to others that are more than 100 feet deep. The wilderness area features more than 1,000 miles of canoe routes, a dozen hiking trails, and more than 2,000 official campsites. Approximately 150,000 people visit the BWCA each year. With that many people roaming the woods and paddling these lakes, it's almost inevitable that someone is going to get injured, lost, or occasionally die.
My name is Henny Youngeman. I'm the chief pilot and the supervisor for the Eastern Region Beaver Program for the U.S. Forest Service. We're based at the Superior National Forest Seaplane Base in Ely, Minnesota.
Historically, planes haven't played a huge part in search and rescue missions across the country unless it is a military operation. In the Boundary Waters, federally designated wilderness, motors of any kind are technically not allowed. The Forest Service does grant permission on rare occasions, including operations where injured canoeists need to be evacuated and time or location make it necessary for a float plane to get involved. There are times when the responders are not able to reach someone in time, Engelman says. In cases like this, the mission changes from search and rescue to recovery.
But, you know, to me, I look at those as like, you know, those are just as important about getting somebody's, you know, family members, their family back to them. I landed off of a search one time to look for somebody who had, there was a canoe that capsized and a couple of guys, it was one of those really windy days and the guys didn't come back to camp, two of them. And so I went and looked for them and ended up finding one of them who was deceased. And he was actually hung up in kind of a tree offshore by his life jacket. And I was really worried that he was going to slip out of it and then he was going to sink and we might never find him. So I basically just parked the airplane and I swam out there and grabbed him and brought him back and loaded him in the airplane. And I felt like that was one of those ones where you kind of have to use your judgment and decision making. But for me, I didn't, there was no way I was going to leave him there and go get a bunch of other people or whatever. So yeah, there's good days and there's bad, but fortunately there's more good than bad.
Nick Howe is the Eastern Regional Aviation Officer for the U.S. Forest Service based in Milwaukee. He is the boss, more or less, of all the Forest Service aircraft that fly near and in the Boundary Waters area. Howe credits former Superior National Forest Supervisor Jim Sanders with getting the planes more involved with search and rescue operations in the BWCA. Sanders was the forest supervisor for the area, including the BWCA, from 1996 to 2011. It's a time when search and rescue calls not only became more frequent, but more advanced. Search and rescue is not a core component of the Forest Service. Rather, the federal agency is characterized as being a support element to the state, who has the authority of search and rescue. Howe says that utilizing float planes, officially known as the Helen Beavers, was a key piece of what Sanders brought to the Boundary Waters in terms of Forest Service response to search and rescue.
He's really the forest supervisor that, if you were to look back at the history of really the involvement of search and rescue, he's the one that started it and said, we need to address this. And at the time, the de Havilland Beavers were at there. So everything evolves in aviation. Because of the technology and people, it becomes a little more complex. We just got to be prepared. But he's really the one that really kind of set the stage for where we're at today.
The Beaver float planes are used across the wilderness, from the far west side near Ely to the eastern side, including the popular corridor along the Gunflint Trail near Grand Marais. Planes are used far more infrequently than ground crews. Many search parties paddle canoes across the BWCA looking for missing people or others in distress. Near the Gunflint Trail, this has ranged from people who got lost walking too far from their campsite to people who accidentally emptied an entire canister of bear spray in their face. The Gunflint Trail is a paved, winding road that snakes between two separated sections of the BWCA. It's long been an area known for wildlife, amazing fishing, and occasionally a place where people find themselves in need of assistance.
Hi, I'm Dan Bauman. I'm from the Gunflint Trail Fire Department, Volunteer Fire Department, originally the Gunflint Trail Fire and Rescue Squad.
Bauman arrived at the Gunflint Trail as a teenager in the early 1960s. His parents purchased Golden Eagle Lodge in the mid-Gunflint Trail area, and the business has been in the family's hands ever since. The Gunflint Trail Fire and Rescue Squad formed in 1981 as the number of calls for help started to slowly but steadily increase. The Gunflint Squad was formed by a half dozen residents of the area, including founding member Bruce Kerfoot, the son of Gunflint Trail legend Justine Kerfoot, who is most famous for starting Gunflint Lodge, her published writings about the region, and for being a guide in and around what is now the BWCA. Bauman joined the Gunflint Rescue Squad in 1982, 1 year after it formed. He says the operation was minimal back then, and the first vehicle the squad used didn't exactly make people feel comfortable when it arrived to the scene.
But, you know, our first ambulance, we'd show up, and it was a hearse with a red bubble on top. I mean, it didn't give you a lot of confidence when the ambulance shows up. It's like they're ready to go. But
It was a hearse.
We got it used, obviously, and it was a hand-me-down. I don't know if we bought it or if it was given to us, but that was our first ambulance.
Similar to the rescue squads in St. Louis and Lake Counties, the Gunflint Rescue Squad has grown over the years. In the early 2000s, the Gunflint Rescue Squad merged with other emergency responders on the trail, and it became known as the Gunflint Trail Volunteer Fire Department. This, Bauman explains, is the Gunflint's team who respond to everything from drownings to wildfires. Many of the calls, from those dating back to the early 1980s to those that happened last summer, are not for the faint of heart.
It's real. It's real life. It's not a movie. Some rescues we've gone in, and I've come out mud head to toe, and it was a negative. You know, everything you did, everything you put yourself through, it ended up with a negative ending. And there's nothing you can do about it. And that's what you have to tell yourself when you go to bed at night. Even after some of these calls that you go on, you get home at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you got a spouse that sits there and then they love you and they talk to you. They go back to sleep and you're sitting there running it and running it and running it. And you're saying, I got to get to sleep. Morning sun's coming up, you know, and I got to get past this. And there's days like that.
What's a negative ending mean?
Negative is the pace you lost them. You didn't save that life. I think I'd speak for all your volunteers in this county is nobody wants to lose somebody on their watch.
Members of the Gunflint Trail Volunteer Fire Department work on a volunteer basis, similar to other search and rescue organizations who respond to emergencies in the Boundary Waters. So why would somebody want to trudge through the mud at 2 a.m. in the dense forests of northeastern Minnesota, particularly when there's a chance someone is going to be critically injured or perhaps dead when they arrive? For Bauman, it's about being a good member of his community, he says, and it's not something he's doing looking for praise.
I don't think I've ever thought about it, but I'm an Eagle Scout, and Eagle Scouts, I mean, you volunteer. My whole life has been volunteering, even when I was a youth. Volunteered for many things. So to do it, it was just another step or another chapter in volunteering for me.
I took a drive up the Gunflint Trail in late fall to check in with another person who has been involved with the fire department in search and rescue for many years. Andy McDonnell is the co-owner of Tuscarora Lodge and Canoe Outfitters. Most of the leaves were off the trees along the Gunflint Trail as I drove more than 45 miles from Grand Marais to Tuscarora Lodge, which is located on Round Lake. There were not many other motorists on the road in the middle of October as I drove up the Gunflint. It was, even by late fall standards, very quiet on the Gunflint Trail when I arrived to Tuscarora to meet with McDonald.
Hey, Joe.
Andy, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Wonderful time of year, October.
Transition time, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You got McDonald is 38 years old. He got involved with search and rescue in the Boundary Waters when he was in his early 20s. He says the reason for getting involved with the fire department and search and rescue were simple.
I mean, at its core, it's just helping people, you know, and that's the same thing. I kind of look at the fire department, search and rescue, it's all the same thing for me. It's all just emergency response to some degree or another. And it's important because, you know, you can help people. You can put their fire, you know, put their house out if it's on fire. You can, you know, if they're having a medical issue, you can get them into an ambulance. If they're lost, you can find them. If they, you know, twist their ankle on a portage, you can help them walk out. You know, it's important to, you know, have those services and to be able to help people that need help, especially in a rural area like this, where there's can be a long time before people can come and, you know, help you.
Though the core of search and rescue in and around the Boundary Waters has remained the same for decades, technology has changed efficiency and response time. Spot devices, Garmin inReach emergency beacons, cell phones picking up a tower near the edge of the BWCA, all of these have improved communication from within to outside the Boundary Waters.
I mean, I remember a time, you know, even in the only whatever 15 years that I was on, I've been on the fire department, you know, in the early years, really those weren't very common. And so when someone got hurt, a lot of times you'd hear about it through like maybe a satellite phone, but more often people would paddle out and say, hey, you know, my guy, you know, he hurt his knee on a portage, we need some help, you know. And now those devices are very common, and I think they definitely, people are getting aid faster for sure.
Slatton with the St. Louis County Rescue Squad agrees that people are able to use technology to notify search parties and the authorities when they're in distress. Oftentimes, this is a good thing, After all, the key word in an emergency response is emergency. However, Slatton says the advancements in technology, including cell phone use in and around the boundary waters as it becomes more widespread, needs to be engaged with in a responsible way.
We're seeing a lot of Garmin inReach, but more often the just cell phones, because with the new armor towers and new cell phone towers up in the boundary waters, it's not uncommon for somebody with a cell phone to hit a dispatch center. And they're calling for stuff that in our day, we would have just dealt with it.
Slatton describes through personal experience that times have changed regarding what constitutes an emergency in the wilderness.
You know, I was on an expedition trip to Isle Royale once, and I broke a couple bones in my hand. And, hey, dress it up, bandage it, and drive on with the mission. You know, yeah, my hand hurts for the rest of the trip. So what? But I'm not calling 911 for help. And we had a guy over on Lake 4 that on the St. Louis County, Lake County line that he lost his paddle. And, well, when we got there, his campsite's on Lake 2, so he's going deeper into the boundary waters on his day trip, and all he's got with him is a water bottle and one paddle. And there's some things that pop into your head when you encounter folks like that that probably aren't fit for radio, but yeah, we took care of him. We took care of him.
Despite calls that might not justify a search and rescue party coming to help someone, on occasion, near tragedies go unreported to a local sheriff's department or the search and rescue squads. I know this firsthand, as I nearly died in the boundary waters in May 2023. It was the day before the fishing opener when I faced a life or death situation on the Temperance River in the BWCA. The ice had come out only a day or two before, and the water was high, cold, and fast in the Temperance. The river widens into a series of lakes near the Baker Lake entry point, a popular area in the BWCA, inland from the small towns of Tofty and Lutzen near Lake Superior. After the first portage, my friend Eric Dickus and I put our canoe above a stretch of rapids on the Temperance. The river, however, pulled us downstream and directly into the rapids we had just carried all of our gear around from the safety of land. Seconds later, we capsized. Eric, the canoe, all our gear, and I were swept to the rapids. About 15 yards downstream, I became pinned on a submerged log, which is known as a strainer in the world of search and rescue. The top half of my body wanted to go over the strainer. My legs, feet, and heavy boots wanted to go under the log. My body contorted into the letter C. Water rushed over my shoulders as I remained stationary, pinned. Eric watched helplessly downstream, having avoided the submerged log as he shot down the rapids. He was able to grab a hanging tree and get to shore. Our other friends ran up the portage and through the dense forest to assist, only to hear my desperate screams grow louder as they approached. After about a half a minute, I knew there was only one person who could help me, and that was myself. I reached down in the roaring river and found the top of the log. I used every bit of strength I had to push up and off the log, eventually rolling free and up over the top of the submerged structure. I was free, and I was alive. Five months later, Slatton from the St. Louis County Rescue Squad accompanied me to the site where I almost died on the Temperance River.
Probably right about here, Rick, I bet, is where the canoe turned. So we turned, now we're in the water, and a straight shot down. I mean, we can almost walk. There's the tree right there.
Strainers are a big deal. Experienced swiftwater techs stay away from them. And here's a hidden one that you found yourself in. There was no evidence that it was even there. and it darn near killed you. And these are not something to trifle around with, and they can happen in small water. Anything knee deep or deeper can haul you away, and a lot of people don't realize that.
Slatton drove from his home near Duluth to Grand Marais in the fall of 2023 to see the place where I almost died in the Boundary Waters. While driving to the Temperance River that afternoon, we spoke about the past, present, and future of search and rescue in the Boundary Waters. Equipment, technology, and even the number of people who are involved with search and rescue have changed over the years, certainly when compared to the era of Slatton's father in the late 1950s. One thing that hasn't changed, and will never change, is the massive area the St. Louis County Rescue Squad covers. The squad's official coverage area is nearly 7,000 square miles, an area that Slatton likes to reference with scale.
Yes, St. Louis County is the biggest county east of the Mississippi. We're the 43rd largest in the United States, and we're just a little bit smaller than the state of New Jersey. So you look at a national map, it's kind of hard to envision that. You look at Minnesota and look at New Jersey, but yeah, we're about that big.
The rescue squad has a variety of ages, and it's not uncommon for someone approaching 70 to be involved. Both men and women are on the squad, including a new member who joined in 2022. This person's name is Matty Fondline, the same guide who had the lightning bolt crash down at her BWCA campsite and who was eventually taken to safety by the rescue squad she later joined.
Gosh, I'm glad to be out here helping my fellow rescue squad folks and helping people who are having a bad time in the woods, because you don't want to have a bad time in the Boundary Waters. That's not why you go to the Boundary Waters. You go to the Boundary Waters to have fun and to have like an impactful experience. You don't go to get rescued.
This is Joe Fredericks reporting.
Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members just like yourself and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Radio without boundaries. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. After the break, another episode of the Mini Culture Podcast. Stay with us.
Welcome to Mini Culture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. When you think of American folk music, a certain picture might come to mind. Acoustic guitar, maybe a banjo, fiddle, upright bass. But the truth is, folk music can vary a lot depending on where you're talking about and what kind of cultural or ethnic traditions are there. Producers Brita Green and James Napoli have this story about tracking down the roots of Minnesota folk music. Here's Brita.
If you were out on a hot summer night in Minneapolis, you might make your way to the Stone Arch Bridge. It's a popular spot for tourists, students, and couples out on dates. And there on the bridge, you might find a guy sitting on a folding chair with his banjo, a white plastic bucket in front of him for tips. His name is Mike Sawyer, and he says these evenings out here are often his favorite part of the day.
It's just so much love and light out here, and I get to watch the hawks and the ravens fly by, and it's just good for my soul to be out here doing this music out here on the bridge.
Mike used to work at a grocery store, restocking shelves, packing bags. That was his day-to-day for more than 20 years. But a few years ago, he did something a lot of people dream about doing, but few people actually do. He quit to focus on what he loves, music. He plays shows around town, teaches lessons, but being out here on the bridge has been a big part of his life.
I think probably the highlight was when this group of church kids, they started dancing out here, and pretty soon the whole bridge was caught up and dancing and hooting and hollering, and it was so much fun. It lasted maybe about 15, 20 minutes. They were trying to square dance and all kinds of stuff. It was just a great time.
Mike's in his early 50s, long, scraggly beard, mostly gray at this point. But he has a soft face and this kind of eager, curious energy that makes him seem half his age. When he was growing up, he played in punk bands and noise bands. But in his 20s, he started getting deeper into old folk tunes, and something just clicked.
You know, bluegrass is one thing, but I like the pre-30s old-time music, the old banjo players. So that's what I started getting into. I got a banjo. And once I had the banjo, it was just, there was no looking back.
There's a strong community of players of this kind of pre-30s folk music, often referred to as old time, here in Minnesota and elsewhere, all over the country. Mike went to festivals, learned all the old standards. But as he was playing more and more of this music, a question started eating away at him. It seemed like all the songs he was now immersing himself in, all everyone at these jams and festivals was playing, these were songs with roots in Appalachia, from the southeastern United States. But what about folk music of the same era from here, from Minnesota and the upper Midwest?
I really started getting curious about the roots of Minnesota music. I really didn't have a full understanding of the music from our state. And I just thought it was funny that all of us sit around at these local festivals and we play all this music from other areas. And I was like, there must be something else.
So we started asking around, particularly among the older musicians in the old time scene.
I remember sitting around the fire, and I had a bunch of 70, 80-year-olds around the fire. And we were playing tunes and stuff, and then in between, I was asking them about it. And they just didn't know.
This question of what happened to, and even what is, the local folk tradition ended up sending Mike on something of a quest.
Yeah, the more that I was told that no one knew, the more I wanted to get into it.
It took him to small towns all over Minnesota and Wisconsin in search of tapes, gathering dust in cardboard boxes, stacked in spare rooms and empty barns, and introduced him to people who have profoundly impacted his life. As Mike started his search, he learned that one reason Appalachian tunes dominate our idea of American folk music is the simple fact that far more of them were professionally recorded.
When the ethnomusicologists went to Appalachia, they did a great job of actually documenting that music.
In the early to mid-1900s, researchers from places like Harvard and Columbia Universities took recording gear down to the American South to archive the music traditions in small towns and mountain hollers.
So all these folks who might have been isolated on mountaintops were kind of spread to the wind by these ethnomusicologists, you know, Alan Lomax and the like.
Alan Lomax. He's perhaps the most famous person to do this work. He's credited with discovering and popularizing people like Leadbelly, Muddy Waters, and Woody Guthrie.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and I called it heaven.
And when Mike says that Alan Lomax spread these musicians to the wind, picture a cloud of seeds that would scatter and grow all across the country. Because that's what happened. Some of these recordings became the source material for the folk revival of the 50s and 60s, with bands like the New Lost City Ramblers using that old-fashioned sound.
Come on, you booze bars, if you want to hear about the kind of booze we sell around here.
This revival movement then inspired generations of musicians who still play what's generally referred to as old-time music today. But this definition, with its limited geography, rubs some people the wrong way.
I'm very annoyed. I'm very annoyed about it.
This is Jim Leary, a folklorist and emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who Mike has worked with a lot over the years. Leary says East Coast academics in the early 1900s had a bias against music from the Midwest.
I feel like the Midwest lacks the antiquity of the East, the tragedy of the South, and the destiny of the West. But, you know, it's... We're here.
The fact is that there was a rich folk tradition going on here, but those East Coast academics weren't as interested, in part because these were newer immigrant and native communities where English wasn't the primary language. Alan Lomax did eventually make one trip to the Midwest. It was the late 1930s. He was working in the federal government for what was then called the Archive of American Folk Song. He was seeking out tunes from lumberjack communities and the Great Lakes.
and he had to make a plea for funds from the music division in the Library of Congress.
Lomax originally budgeted for just 3 months. He thought that'd be enough time to make it through all of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, thinking he could capture everything that would be worth recording in that time.
You know, once he arrived in Michigan, and especially in the UP, where there were all these French Canadians and Finnish performers, he realized he had more than he could handle.
These are the actual recordings Lomax made on his trip. The first one you heard was Finnish fiddlers, and here French fiddlers in small towns on Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
And he got to Wisconsin for, I think, about one day to the Bad River Ojibwe Reservation, and he recorded a guy named Joe Cloud.
These fiddle tunes are being recorded by Joe Cloud in Odena, Wisconsin on October the 16th, 1938.
And by then, he was out of money. He wrote back to his supervisor. He says, "I'm not wastreling, but you can't do field work in Michigan and in this region without beer." So he bought a lot of beer, apparently.
So contrary to earlier assumptions, Lomax figured out the folk music of the Midwest was just as rich and diverse as other regions of the country. In fact, there was enough music in the area to consume a folklorist for years. In all, he recorded about 1,000 songs, and he urged the Library of Congress music director to send him back the following summer, writing, quote, "In many ways, it is the most interesting country I have ever traveled in." But soon, World War II broke out, and his attention was diverted. Leary says there were some other recordings made in Wisconsin shortly after Lomax's trip, but few to none in Minnesota.
The actual recorded evidence we have from the upper Midwest in comparison to the southern Appalachian region, we have very scant records.
What that leaves is a real void, a silence here, when it comes to archives of upper Midwest music. Lomax's 1,000 or so recordings, mostly from Michigan, leave out Minnesota entirely and pale in comparison to the rich archive he and his colleagues had been developing across the South. And to Mike, that's an incredible shame, because this area was far from quiet. There was music being played in communities up and down the Mississippi, from the North Woods to the prairies in the South. He was convinced he could find some material.
I started to talk to, you know, try to broaden my circle, talk to as many folks as I could about it, get leads from leads from leads, you know, kind of following it down the old-fashioned way. Because what I learned quick is this stuff is not on the internet. Like, forgotten music.
Good morning, and we're all revved up for Bluegrass Saturday morning. I'm your host.
One of the people he reached out to is a man named Phil Nussbaum. Phil is known for a bluegrass show he's been hosting on local radio in the Twin Cities for more than 3 decades. And Mike knew him as an expert on old folk tunes. It also just so happened that Phil frequented the grocery store where Mike used to work.
I'd walk in there to get, I usually get spices there and also dried beans.
So Mike would chat him up at the checkout counter or in the bulk aisle.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember chatting with him about food a lot, and I remember chatting with him about music.
And I can't remember when we first started talking about old time. It was great to have somebody actually interested in the music from around here.
Mike had heard that Phil had actually done some recordings himself in the 80s. He'd heard Phil had spent some time in people's living rooms recording folks playing tunes they'd been passed down by their parents and grandparents. This was exactly the kind of thing Mike was looking for.
And so then I was like, oh, you know, can I hear those tapes?
Phil had no problem sharing the recordings, and Mike finally got to hear one small piece of the missing Midwest folk music tradition he'd been searching for.
The tapes are amazing. They're like wonderful and beautiful.
These are recordings Phil made of Norwegian-American players in Winona and Duluth in 1987.
And so he just went up and he turned the mic on.
Are we rolling?
Yeah, we are.
Oh.
Okay. He would get a song, And then he would ask a question. He was great at asking these open-ended questions. And then sometimes the old guys would be like, oh, whatever, let's play more tunes. And then sometimes, you know, he did a little bit out of them. And those stories are just as fascinating as the music.
Where did you learn these songs, by the way?
My mother.
I've learned most of them from my brother Oliver, learned them mostly from Torstein Skarning, that came from out of Minneapolis up to Minot, North Dakota in the 30s.
Listening to these recordings from the 80s, Mike was amazed. He couldn't believe Phil's material hadn't gotten more attention.
I digitized all of his tapes, and I think they are totally incredible. Each one could be released in itself and be like works of art.
Phil hadn't captured these songs in their prime, when they were being played more frequently and widely, but he'd come right at the end of a critical window where they still were being played, when a generation who learned them as children was still alive. Mike came to learn that there were a couple men who came before Phil doing this work. Starting in the 60s, they made recordings of people playing old folk songs across Minnesota. And slowly, Mike started to piece together a picture of an incredibly rich musical tradition across the state. He did this with the help of people like Jim Leary, the folklorist at the University of Wisconsin, who pointed not just to Scandinavian tunes.
But places like New Ulm, Sleepy Eye, heavily German. You go around Winona or northeast Minneapolis, there are strong Polish settlements.
In Montgomery and Worthington and New Prague, there were Czech and Bohemian communities. On the Iron Range, a strong Slovenian button box accordion tradition. And there were the Finns up in Cloquet. There was also plenty of Irish music in St. Paul.
And then, of course, there are very strong Anishinaabe or Ojibwe, where not only the big drum and the more traditional and kind of powwow scene things happen, but there were a lot of so-called Métis or French Indian. They picked up fiddling as early, you know, through the fur trade and lumber camps, and there were fiddling and step dancing kinds of sounds.
And in many areas, what happened naturally was a mixing of styles. Neighbors would share tunes, as would men working alongside each other on farms, in the mines, or in lumber camps. And what developed was something of a local Upper Midwest vernacular, not pure Norwegian music or Irish or Polish, but a blend, an evolution. There was actually one musician, one fiddler in particular, who was captured on some of the tapes Mike found, who he couldn't get out of his head. His name was Leonard Finseth, a Norwegian-American from rural Wisconsin.
He was a farmer fiddler who lived his whole life on the same farm, basically. And I love the way he plays. He plays with a little bit of the old-school Norwegian flavor, but definitely its own, like, middle Wisconsin vibe.
And so Mike set about trying to track down anyone who might have some more recorded material of Finseth's playing and history.
I was looking for family members, I wrote his son, I called his son several different times, and I just heard that, you know, his son doesn't want anything to do with the music, and he wouldn't return my calls, and we were like that. And so I thought I was a dead end, right?
Then one day, Mike's playing music at a totally unrelated festival. He's playing old Appalachian tunes.
And this guy comes up to me. And he says, I'm Larry. I've been looking all over for you. I'm Larry. I'm like, oh, hi, Larry. How are you doing? I'm Larry Finseth. I'm like, oh, you related to Leonard? You know, he's like, yeah, I'm his nephew.
Mike couldn't believe it. Turns out Larry Finseth grew up right next to his uncle, Leonard Finseth, out in the country in Wisconsin. Still lives there today.
Leonard, he got together with the other fiddlers around here.
This is Larry talking about his uncle Leonard, the fiddler.
Stanley Lairdal. Laverne Lairdal, Ralph Gallingshrud, and there was numerous other ones that he would stop in and share. Haying season, you know, they'd bale up some hay, you know, and then have a get-together at somebody's house, you know, and maybe have a beer and play a few fiddle tunes, and that was it.
And so it ends up that Larry's one of the ones who grew up playing guitar with his uncle, but wants nothing to do with it now. Plays bluegrass music exclusively now, right? And he was amazed to find someone actually excited about, like, his uncle's music, you know? So my excitement, I think, got him back into being excited about it.
Okay.
Larry's in his late 70s now. I went to visit him at his home, tucked at the end of a dirt road, surrounded by woods and farm fields.
This here, I'm going to let you take that right out on the table.
He took out boxes and boxes of old cassette tapes with handwritten labels. We sorted through photo albums that featured old photos of musicians and lumber camps.
Okay, so this here is one of the records of Leonard's. And here's a booklet that came along with it. So there's a lot of history in those two that a lot of people do not have.
He told me as a kid he had a cassette recorder, and when his uncle and other local fiddlers would start to play, without thinking too much about it, he'd hit record and capture tape after tape.
I always recorded it. And why? Nobody else was doing it.
These tapes don't get much use anymore. He loaded one up in an old stereo by the window in the kitchen.
Probably put it in backwards.
We waited to hear what the tape had actually preserved.
Here's another old square dance tune. Possibly a polka tune, too.
That was better.
Later, he says his daughter continued on with the tradition, recording on VHS. All this material, the audio and the video recordings, were incredibly valuable to Mike. And not only that, but it wasn't just tapes of Leonard that Larry had. He'd also been collecting material from his neighbors.
Oh, yes, over here at Stanley Lardell's place. Stanley had all of his playing stuff out in the garage, and he would heat it in the wintertime. But when Stanley passed away, it was 1 year later, all of his cassette tapes were still in that same spot. And I'm thinking, if I don't try and get some of that, you know, it'll be gone forever. So I did.
So we took a deep dive. He gave me all his VHSs of him and Leonard playing in the past. I mean, he sent me, basically, people turn their whole life's archives over to me sometimes. I'm kind of amazed by what people will turn over to me without me even asking, right? And pictures and all kinds of stuff.
I had to do something. I just see that the music died out here in this area totally. Totally. After Leonard, Ralph, and Stanley passed away, it's dead. It's done and gone.
Mike never got to meet Leonard, the fiddler, on all these old recordings, but he says there's something about him that reminds him of his own grandpa. And listening to these tapes, Mike's just developed a deep personal connection to Leonard's music. Leonard is buried at his old Lutheran church outside of Eau Claire, and whenever Mike's in the area, he makes a point to stop by.
I still go and I play a few tunes. Clear off his grave's always covered. I go clear off his grave and I play a few tunes by there just because he feels so familiar, even though I never met him, you know?
For years, Mike would travel around just like this, talking to more and more people, amassing his own archive of tapes stored in boxes in his basement. He posts about his adventures, what he's learning about the music and the people on his website. He's put out 2 CDs. But the sad thing Mike's learned is, even though you can find these old recordings and you can meet folks who remember their parents or grandparents playing at home, virtually no one is really playing these songs anymore.
They are literally archival material at this point. The stories are numerous that, you know, you'd have a guy come over in 1800 and then you'd have his kids play and his kid's kid and keep going down the line 4 generations. And then these last 2 generations just completely dropped it. Why you wouldn't be interested in your great-great-grandfather's old fiddle music, I have no clue. But, you know, it's the story that we hear over and over again is that they just lost it.
So over time, Mike developed this dream of finding people still alive today who are part of a living tradition of the music, who still know how to play it, having learned from their parents or grandparents. People keeping the music alive. And he came to learn that these people do exist. They're few and far between, but they're here, like tiny stars on a map of an otherwise pitch black sky.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
This is a fiddler named Beth Rotto, based in Decorah, Iowa. She learned from a fiddler named Bill Sherburn, who passed away in 1991. And here, a now 89-year-old fiddler who Mike visited in Thief River Falls, about 5 hours northwest of the Twin Cities, named Hillary Stoltman.
Yeah, one time I went up there, it was the day before Thanksgiving, and he made like a whole 9-course Thanksgiving meal for me. I mean, it was like amazing. He shared a whole box of artifacts with me, trusted me to take them, shared his whole box of tapes, all of the tapes from his life and his father's life.
What you're hearing is one of those recordings Hillary shared. Mike eventually worked on a tune book of Hillary Stoltman's songs, listening to these tapes and painstakingly transcribing them note by note, each song taking 2 or 3 hours to get down. And in Two Harbors, up on the North Shore, I went to visit a man named Paul Dahlin, who is carrying on a Swedish fiddling tradition he learned from his grandfather, who was a more recent immigrant to the United States, moving to Minneapolis in the 1920s.
We had tape recorders, so I would record Grandpa's tunes, or he would say, I remembered another tune from, I don't remember how, it's been so long since I played that. And he would record it, and I'd take it home and learn it.
Paul took out his fiddle and tuned it up to play a few songs, accompanied by his wife, Mary Kay.
The signature tune is Year to Be, Gonglot, Year to Be Loten, which is very known.
He says it's just his hunch, but he thinks part of the reason the old Scandinavian music hasn't remained popular is it's relatively slow as far as fiddle music goes.
We played an intermission of a fiddle contest. We weren't in the fiddle contest. We were music in the intermission. So we're playing a polska. And it's totally uninteresting to everyone in the seated. And one lady in the audience says, play something fast. Once you hear it and you understand and you get into this and you hear the richness of a lot of the tunes, then you're drawn in. But it doesn't come at the audience and dazzle them.
Okay, what do you say, Chris?
And finally, in Canton, South Dakota, about 30 minutes through the cornfields outside of Sioux Falls, I went to visit a group Mike told me about this past fall.
Okay, I can do G.
They were practicing for a public performance of old Danish music later that night, packed into the living room of Bill Peterson, who lives in town. Bill learned these songs from another 89-year-old musician named Dwight Lamb, a close friend. Bill says Dwight learned from his grandpa growing up. His grandpa would play a tune on the accordion and then pass it to Dwight so he could try his hand.
He told me once that when he was a little kid, his grandpa would play for him every night, and one night he didn't get out the accordion and Dwight started crying. And he wouldn't shut up until his grandpa played a tune. You know, Dwight learned those tunes like his grandfather played them, didn't change them hardly at all. And so when people in Denmark got a hold of one of Dwight's CDs with a few accordion tunes on it, they were mystified by the fact that nobody in Denmark played like that anymore, you know, because it was old music and it was played like it was 100 years ago. I started playing it around here because I'm from here, you know, so it just kind of felt like coming home.
When Mike first started on this project, first started researching Upper Midwest Old Time, his initial thought was to start a band, to share the music through CDs, through live shows. But then he realized that wasn't going to work.
when I got into it, just everything changed for me. I realized, like, a band doesn't solve the issue. You know, like, a band doesn't hit where I want it to go. That really what I want is I want a movement. I want a rebirth of this stuff. And a band doesn't really do that. It would make it personally, like, I might be more personally successful doing a band, but it wouldn't be as culturally significant, I thought.
So he decided eventually to start his own group, where he could teach the music to anyone who's interested, with the goal of building a community of players, a community that would grow and grow.
Okay, drag out the first beat on the Selma Ramsey Mazurka.
They call themselves the Upper Midwest Folk Fiddlers, meet every Tuesday night in a brightly lit classroom in a recreation center in the Edgecombe neighborhood of St. Paul. Mike ultimately wants to start groups like this in other areas, particularly in rural areas where the music really used to flourish. And he wants to get it in the hands of children, too, so the next generation can experience it. He says sometimes this mission feels like molasses, so slow, but he just keeps pushing forward.
Okey-dokey.
Played that one nice, everybody. That was a good speed, good flow for it.
I talked with Jim Leary, the folklorist at UW-Madison, about Mike's passion for this work. And he told me a story about one night in 2015 when he was putting on a concert in St. Paul featuring folk songs from this area. Mike was one of the performers. At the end of the night, Jim was splitting up the proceeds with the musicians.
I was handing out, you know, cash to the different performers, and Mike refused to take any. He said, I should keep it for the cause. You know, that really struck me. I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, kind of scraping, I think, to make a living. He's doing all this research on his own. And I should have shoved it back and said, you know, then you spend it for the cause. And so I kept very careful track of those funds and made sure that, you know, I put them somewhere that spoke to Mike's intentions. But it just, for the cause, you know.
For Mike, this project to archive not just the tunes, but also the stories that go with them, this has become a true calling in his life.
When you get to talking to the old-timers and they start telling you stories, the real old-timers, they tell you about these magical times where, you know, they flower up the dance floor in the barn and that all these different ethnicities come together, whether it was a barn raising or whether it was, you know, a wedding or whatever it might be. Saturday night, you know, they'd hit the dance floor at 8 p.m. and they might not be done till 5 in the morning sometimes.
He thinks part of what's driving him to spend the likely thousands of hours he spent on this project is a longing for a feeling of social connection that just doesn't feel as tangible in our world today.
They would talk about, oh, there being, you know, Johnny down the block who plays this instrument or this guy who dances or whatever on this block. And I look at my block and I think, I barely know anybody on this darn block, you know. There's nothing that brings us together. There's nothing that holds us in.
Mike says that sometimes, leading up to the weekly Tuesday night sessions, he's dragging. Just like anything else, it's hard to get himself out the door. But then he walks in, sees the people, is surrounded by the music, and something shifts.
One, two, three, one, two.
At some point in the night, it always feels magical again, because it's like somebody will ask a question about something, or this tune will feel particularly good, and it's starting to feel like home. It's starting to feel like, you know, if you're out on the farm and you're getting together every week with these people, it's starting to feel like a thing that's not going to go away.
For KFAI, I'm Breetu Green.
This story was written and produced for Miniculture by Breetu Green and James Napoli. Special thanks to Jim Leary and the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for sharing many of the audio recordings in this piece, including from the Down Home Dairyland recordings. Additional thanks to Rob McGinley Myers, Nancy Rosenbaum, Sophie Nikitas, Chris Anderson, and members of the Upper Midwest Folk Fiddlers. Mini Culture is a production of KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sensulo. More episodes are coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed to Mini Culture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Thanks for listening.
This is Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Coming up next, Upside Down.